Welcome, and it's good to be with you. Tim, Jane, Atticus, Rosa, thank you. Oh man, really, thanks for giving me a chance to talk about some ideas and to explore what we believe. Like I believe in this, I value it tremendously. There's so many ways in which I shape my life around this community and these conversations. And I'm not saying that because it's some kind of grand thing, just by way of illustrating that I love that we get to do this. And that's all true. And sometimes I hit the end of the music time, I hit the end of people just talking about whatever's going on in their life and whatever setting, and I just feel like, whatever church is, whatever the table is, if we don't want to use church language for it, man, I just got a big refreshing drink of it right there, and I'm good. I'm good. Let's go for a walk in the park. And I mean, we sort of had that all queued up too, right? But these things come and go. So we'll carry on this way, and we will do what we can to respond with gratitude and to cherish these things we have. Just a quick thing that came to mind during our music time this morning. First song, I think, especially Rosa was just like, I mean, we couldn't see her, but we could totally hear her. She was singing along like at the top of her lungs. It was so awesome. And I was thinking about Taya and I right now are reading Daniel Levitin's book, This Is Your Brain on Music, together. And a former rock musician, producer turned neuroscientist, talking about the intersection between music and the brain, and how that all works. And one of the stories he tells in there is about a colleague of his who is with the, I think, the Dasato people, West Africa. I might have the details wrong about the tribe, but he's doing ethnocultural musical research with these folks, and he kind of wins them over. He's a very quiet, shy person, and he kind of wins them over eventually just by being with them and being kind and sensitive to their culture and their practices. And at one point they invite him into a celebration of theirs, which involves singing and dancing. And he's not just being shy, Levitin says. He actually can't sing. He couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, to use his words. And so he says to these people who've extended this invitation to him, he says, I can't sing. And they look at him like he's nuts. Like they look at him like, what do you mean you can't sing? You can talk, right? You can breathe, right? So that means you can sing, because in their culture, everybody sang and everybody danced. In fact, in their culture, they didn't have a separate word for singing and dancing. That was the same thing, because if you were singing, you were moving, right? Like that's just the way it worked. And Levitin goes on to talk about, this sort of 50s idea of like the family around the piano and singing together. And I listen to Rosa sing, and I think, there are going to be not just things that have been taken from us by a pandemic, but also things that have been given to us by a pandemic. And I listen to that thing happen in your living room, Tim and Jane, and I feel like, of course, it could have happened without a pandemic. But some of the impetus for facing the unique challenges of doing this together as a family with young kids in this way and sharing it with the community live the way you have so generously, sort of a bunch of the impetus for that was necessity. It was pandemic driven, if you will. And man, I don't know if it always feels like a gift on your end. I mean, I'm a parent, so I'm guessing probably not. Sometimes it just feels like work, but it hits me as a gift every time. So thank you. And there are other ways people in this community and in other communities are finding to share one another's lives under these circumstances and to share the gift of time together in whatever shape is appropriate to the details of the pandemic and the season we're in as a culture. I'm so grateful for that. So glad to be a part of it. I want to, as is my practice, acknowledge that the land on which we gather is Treaty One land. And we're grateful as non-treaty people, those of us in the community that are not, to be received by the treaty people, by the people for whom this land has been home from before what our Western minds think of as history. We don't all need the reminder that we live in a culture that's built on systemic injustice, because some of us see the reality of it every day, but there's lots of us, especially those of us with European or or settler or colonial ancestry, who we don't experience that reality in the same way every day. And so we need to be reminded. At least I know I need to be reminded. I look at the world with a keener eye to its injustice and inequity when I remind myself out loud that this is an ongoing issue. So that's all bound up in land acknowledgement for me. I need to do that. Thank you for listening. I also need to stop and breathe. I just need to feel my body settle in here a little bit and rest into what we're going to do together for the next half an hour and into the circumstances under which we're doing it. So I'm going to stop and breathe. You're very welcome to join in, of course. What we'll do this morning, those of us who are going to engage this together, is just the very simplest practice of big breath in, cradle your breath down deep into your body, as deep down into your trunk and your torso as you can. Fill yourself right up. Cradle your breath. Because it's going to be a count of three for me, and then all the way out. And let's do five big breath in, breath outs together, and then we'll go on with our exploration. All right? All right. Let's breathe together. Peace. I lost count. That's a lovely feeling, losing count. Well, thanks for sharing that. I want to introduce a fairly pragmatic, multi-day, multi-part talky bit about something that many of us might be feeling these days, and maybe especially this week as our public health measures become more directive, more restrictive. And once this particular exploration gets rolling, I think we're going to find that it's both really intriguing and, in the end, very practical. That said, it could be experienced as having nothing to do with exploring what we believe, especially if we think that belief should sort of be kept in discrete boxes when it comes to spirituality. So if we think that beliefs should be hived off into categories like sacred versus secular, or religious versus irreligious or non-religious, or even spiritual versus physical, if that's kind of how we approach what we believe, then the perspective I'm going to take on this might be rub you the wrong way right from go. But I think especially this would be the case if we struggle with spiritual versus physical, if we sort of feel like these things don't have much to do with one another. So I want to give us a little bit of context for that challenge right off the top. I can't speak to other religions in this regard except in the very most general terms, but I can tell you that the versions of Christianity that I've been in or around much of my life really were not, and in many cases are not, kind to the body. In fact, in my experience, our bodies were often presented as the main thing that gets in the way of our being properly formed spiritually, or in the way of right living, or in the way of moral rightness, or not sinning, and that kind of thing. Well, Misty touched on this a few weeks ago when she was having that conversation with Judy about body shaming, and just kind of dipped into the relationship between Christianity and diet culture. When we explore that more, which is something we're talking about doing and working toward, if we get into that exploration, we will almost inevitably be walking into the myriad ways in which male-dominated patriarchal theologies, ideas about God and God's relationship to humanity, reinforce uniquely oppressive ideas about femaleness and femininity in particular. And man, those are, if we get in there, those are deep woods. But a really important place to go. So we'll keep working toward that as a talky bit idea and jump in there at some point. But there are other reasons why the Christian religion has had, and in many instances continues to have, all kinds of problems with bodies and with bodies versus what we might choose to call spirit or soul. We could probably pretty much explore that forever and not run out of material, but I'm going to take a particular slant on it today to set up this exploration that I want to get into for the next week or two after this one. You will, of course, be able to find all kinds of evidence contrary to the lens that I'm going to choose. This is a debate that's been going on, since the first century, in terms of Christianity at least, and it's still just steaming along full force. So if you want to get into the other perspectives, like knock yourself out, they're out there. But for our purposes today, I'm going to say that a substantial part of the root of the problem, of this particular problem of Christianity being hard on bodies, is too much time spent hanging out with the Apostle Paul. And I'm not saying there's nothing good in there, but there's some issues around this. And for those of us who didn't grow up churched, which is an important part of our community, Paul is a profoundly influential first century figure who is sometimes credited, even to this day, with having written as many as 13 of the 27 books in the New Testament. So this huge percentage of the writings that are gathered together in the library labeled the New Testament are often credited to this person, to Apostle Paul, to Saul of Tarsus, to use a pre-conversion name for him. His take on a lot of things has ridden the wave of historical Christendom. Christendom as opposed to Christianity, Christendom being a little word nerd moment, Christendom being the period in history where church and state were so interlocked, and when the prevailing values, this is sort of a European version of history, when the prevailing values in Europe were Christian values. And so we had a Christian state at that point in history. And so these ideas about what it means to live right in the culture, that the way the culture says this is how things ought to be, was interlocked with the way medieval or Middle Ages Christianity said things ought to be. And so that's Christendom. That's why the different word instead of just Christianity. So during that period in history, the influence of Paul's writings on the shape of culture was huge. Huge. So pervasive and powerful as to be invisible because it was just the way things were in the culture, right? Just a super powerful influence on cultural norms. Not least of all because much of Paul's writing, or the writing attributed to Paul, is writing from a religious authority figure, Paul, to these newly formed Christian communities. Wherever he traveled, he started churches and Christian churches, and he started them. And so they had his imprint on them, his values, his ideas, his interpretations of things. And he would write to these communities and say, folks, you need to do better with this. You need to do this different. You need to relate to one another like this. You need to think about your bodies like this. And so that's what all the characteristics of many of those writings are, just that kind of really pragmatic, here's how you should live sorts of stuff. And because it was carried into culture with the power and force of the state, during the period of Christendom, they just became the ideas of the Western world. And so that's what I mean by pervasive and invisible. Now, that works fine as long as the culture supports the ideas. So let's just illustrate this a little bit. One of the hugely influential realms for Paul's thinking and writing has to do with his perspective on male authority, on patriarchy. And in Paul's undisputed opinion, this is the nature of the world. It is vertical and it is male and then female. That's the way the structure is meant to work. Now, we should serve one another. Paul also says that. So there, he kind of hints at some of these ideas from Jesus' teaching that are about equality and egalitarianism. And even, I'm going to use the term not technically communism in the sense of sharing everything equally. He gestures toward those things in meaningful ways. But in the end, you want to sum up Paul's take on women. It's they should be seen and not heard. And that kind of an idea about gendered authority and verticality stays pretty intact in the culture until, and so it gets reinforced, until the culture starts to challenge it. And so we might want to point here in this part of the world, on this continent, we might want to point to movements in the culture like feminism, as a broad, for instance, and say there's these things going on in the culture that start to challenge this male-dominated patriarchal image of a right society. And when the culture stops supporting those ideas, all of a sudden they get re-examined and we come back to their sources. We start to go, where did that come from anyway? And to rethink it. And that's a significant part of how change happens. So a lot of that has to do with Paul and what Paul believed about bodies and God and how God relates to humans with bodies. sort of famously someone who would say, I punished my body to free my soul, right? Woo! Hard to feel good about your body when it's just getting in the way of being freed spiritually. So Paul had issues with his body, personally. And in his writing, it's pretty clear that these were significant. They were big, powerful issues for him. They're ill-defined because it seems like he can't even get himself to name them. He just can't say what they actually are. I don't know if you've ever been around any of those nerdy, I'm educated about the Bible conversations. Oh man, I know some of you have. So right now, I can visualize some people for whom this is just like, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. But if you've ever been around those kind of conversations, then you might have been part of one that speculated a fair bit about what was up with Paul and his so-called besetting sin, whatever the something that he suffered with physically that he regarded as sent to him by God to sort of, like keep him humble. Anyway, I don't think it worked, frankly. It would be my opinion either. Paul could come off as incredibly arrogant, but he had this thing, whatever it was, and there's something going on with him that's so significant about him and his body and even his appearance, which we'll talk about in a moment, that at one point he thanks a community that he's writing with for not spitting him out of the community the first time they meet him because of how he looked. So we don't really know what the details are because he never talks about them. There are some other writers who talk about them. From that same period, there is, for instance, a text from the 2nd century, an early Christian document. It's called the Acts of Paul, in which Paul is described in a little more detail as a bald-headed, bow-legged, short man with a big nose and an unbroken eyebrow that lay across his forehead like a dead caterpillar. Whew. Okay. Anyway, not flattering. Now, the person that wrote that book, second century church leader, they got fired. They got fired over the book because, among other things, they attributed in the book, they attributed to Paul some unorthodox teachings such as sexual abstinence in marriage. Now, I'm just speculating here, but maybe that wasn't the advice that the patriarchs were looking for when it came to their own sex lives and marriages. I don't know. But anyway, he got canned for that one. So it goes. In any case, a lot of ink has been spilled on the matter of the Apostle Paul and body issues, and I'm not really interested in getting into a debate that in the end is based on very little sort of textual information. But I am really interested in the impact that that debate has had and continues to have on lots of people, including people in the community, and I would include myself in that, and on Western culture in general, when it comes to how we understand our bodies. And in the case of this particular exploration in our community that I want to launch this morning, in particular, how we view our bodies and stress. And you might not sort of think that, this first century guy who had some of his own issues might have something to do with the way we approach in the 21st century here in North America, the way we approach our bodies and stress. But it does. It's that pervasive. Now, if there's anybody around right now, these days, right here, that isn't experiencing our current moment in history as stressful, I've yet to meet them. If I did meet them and they made the claim that none of this was stressful for them, then I would confess to being a skeptic right from go, and I would need to be convinced otherwise. Now, having said that, I know that our circumstances vary and that some people are experiencing these days as much more stressful than others. So I'm going to generalize this a bit further, and I'm going to say we all experience stressors and stress of some nature. And I'm distinguishing here between stressors, the things that cause us stress, and stress itself, because they're distinct from one another. And that idea of the distinguishing between stressors and stress, that's going to become a significant idea for us as we go along in this exploration. Now, before I dive into the details, I want to give some credit where it's due. The perspective that I'll be working with, as well as much of the material that I'll be referencing, are drawn from two sources. One is a book by Doctors Emily and Amelia Nagoski, twin sisters, as it turns out. The book is called Burnout: The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. And so that's a primary source. And in addition to that, an interview that Brené Brown conducted with the two authors. So those are my two primary sources. Now, given the title of the book, Burnout, right off the top, you might be sort of thinking, well, I'm not struggling with burnout. I know what that is, and I know who gets it, and it's not me, and so this doesn't apply. I would say just hang in there for a little bit. You might find that the application is broader than the particular word might suggest. We'll get to sort of all of that. And the other credit I want to give right off the top is that this idea, this exploration, was gifted to me from somebody in our wider online community, somebody not from right here in Winnipeg at the moment. And if you're listening, you know who you are. Thank you. This has been a very meaningful thing for me to explore and will continue to be. So I really appreciate that. I'm finding this stuff personally inspiring. And I get that as a person who's talking and, you know, to a group of people that are listening, so this kind of broadcast model, one voice, many ears, I get that the fact that it really resonates for me doesn't mean that it resonates for everybody, and also that we don't all have time for the whole exploration. So what I want to do is just give you the Coles Notes version of where we're headed today, just in case you sort of need to grab and run or choose to do so. So here's the very short version of basically where we're headed. Emotions, in this case, in the case of this exploration, particularly stress, exist in our bodies all the time. They're always in our bodies. Undealt with, stress will make us sick, even very sick. And in this case, we're sort of summarizing the impact of undealt with stress as burnout. So that's the linkage to the word. But there are lots of ways to deal with stress and stressors. And what I'm finding is that most of those start to make more sense and become more applicable when we understand how emotions work in our bodies and how we can move through emotions in our bodies. So it's that linkage, right, between body and feeling is super important. So there's a Coles Notes. So by way of just a little bit of more technical background, Herbert Freudenberger, 1975 document, the fruit of his research, provides us with this core definition of burnout that we're going to start with. So that's where this definition comes from and these core ideas. So there's three components to Freudenberger's definition of burnout. The first is emotional exhaustion, which he defines as the fatigue that comes from caring too much for too long. Emotional exhaustion, the fatigue that comes from caring too much for too long. And the second component is a decreased sense of accomplishment, which he defines as this uncomfortable sense of futility, the feeling that nothing you do makes any difference. Oh, man. 1975, okay. The guy wasn't prescient. He wasn't writing about the pandemic, but I read these definitions and I'm like, interesting. Yeah, that applies. And the third component of burnout, as Freudenberger defines it, is depersonalization, which he defines as the depletion of empathy, caring, and compassion. Right. I don't know, anybody out there can relate to any of those? I was like, check, 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 you know. So research in this field, though, started out as being primarily about men, primarily about businessmen, and primarily about high-level businessmen, executives. It started out being about leadership and executive burnout among male leaders. And it stayed in that realm for a long, long time. That's what burnout research was about. And it's just within the last 5 years or so that there has begun to be more research that sort of broadens this field, and in particular, that broadens it into the realm of parental or caregiver burnout. If you're a parent, especially a parent with young kids, maybe, or not exclusively, but there is, I think, a unique aspect to this with the young. You know, there's probably some identification with some of those descriptions anyway. And I mean, let's talk about compassion fatigue for a moment, because this is one we're basically swimming in these days. And we might think that if we don't have little kids, or we don't have an aging parent, or someone with unique developmental challenges that we're responsible for, some sort of unique caregiving demand in our lives, we might sort of feel like we're not in the queue for this, or if we're not out on Lesbos, you know, rescuing people from the Mediterranean, like maybe we think, oh, well, that should be fine. I'm not really queued up for compassion fatigue. That's a different category. But even if we're not sick these days, many of us are worried about other people getting sick, people that we care about, people in general, vulnerable populations, to use a current phrase. I can't count the the number of people that I know, in particular young people. I mean, we've got college age and young adult kids, and them and their friends, caring group of young people, man, just beautiful people that are taking extraordinary precautions in their lives, even when they're not demanded by the protocols that are handed to us by the province, taking extraordinary precautions because they love their grandparents, because they love other people who are vulnerable in ways that they, as young people, are statistically not. And they're just doing the work because they care. So they're worried about the wellness of other people in their lives. And that kind of care, good thing, right? That kind of care can lead to emotional exhaustion. It can lead to the depletion of all these resources we draw on to care for one another, things like empathy and compassion and just caring generally. So that's about emotional exhaustion. And emotional exhaustion is one of these particular features of the thing that Freudenberg is calling burnout that is most strongly linked to negative impacts on our health and our relationships and our work. And this is especially true for women who, even in cultures that are tilted more toward equal distribution of these things, end up with the second and third shifts of care, taking on the extra care demands more than men do. And I realize I'm using just two gender categories here. That's partly because of the age of the research. I would say that our contemporary, both colloquial experiences and also increasingly our research, says that marginalized groups bear more of the burden, and that includes people that are not who are gender nonconforming, women, and other marginalized communities, including people that are marginalized for racial, ethnic, or economic reasons. Which brings us to one of the things in this book that I felt like I was aware of in general terms, but I didn't really understand. And that was how emotions work in the body, how they work in my body and in your body. Emotions, the Nagoskis write, are cycles. Emotions are neurological events that happen in our bodies. Emotions are an involuntary neurological response. Now, we can kind of go, yeah, great. Think about this for a moment. Our neurological system, our nervous system, stretches from the top of our head to the tip of our toes, includes all of the surface of our skin, and actually reaches beyond our skin. All you have to do to make sense of that is just hold your hand next to something too warm, and you'll kind of go, oh, yeah, that's right. That's my nervous system outside of my skin telling my skin back away, right? So, this is a huge system for us in terms of our human experience. And emotions are neurological events. They activate that entire system when they happen. So, it's huge, right? The idea that emotions are neurological events that are a cycle, that's an idea that's very important as we go, because that means that emotions are neurological events that have a beginning, a middle, and an end. We'll get back to that. If you want a metaphor for this, the one the authors choose, and which I found very resonant, is the idea that feelings and emotions being synonyms here, feelings are tunnels. And we have to go all the way through them to get to the light at the end. Exhaustion is what happens when we don't go all the way through the tunnel. So we experience exhaustion when we get stuck in an emotion, when we don't move all the way through it. Just about every system in our bodies responds to the chemical and electrical cascade that is activated by emotion, by the dominoes that happen inside of us. Emotion is automatic, it is instantaneous, it happens everywhere because our neurological system is everywhere, and it affects everything because, again, that system is connected to everything. We kind of have this post-Enlightenment love affair with the idea about ourselves as humans that we are cognitive, rational beings that on occasion feel kind of head first, you know? And that is the root of both the thought and I would say the dismissive language of it's just a feeling, right? That's sort of head first, then feelings. But pet research from the past decade has clearly shown us that we are emotional beings that on occasion think, not thinking beings that on occasion feel. For those of you who just have to know what acronyms mean, PET imaging is not cat videos. It stands for positron emission tomography. It's a functional imaging technique. It uses radioactive substances that are known as radio tracers to visualize and measure things in metabolic processes, things that are going on inside of our bodies and in other physiological activities. So things like it measures things like blood flow and regional chemical composition and absorption, all that kind of stuff. So in other words, PET or PET is a way to see what's happening inside our bodies, including inside our brains as physiological organs, and chemical organs while it's happening. And so as this research has developed, it's allowed us to observe what's really going on when certain things, when we feel certain things. And that's why this idea is being reversed right at the moment. This idea that we're rational first and then feeling, that's now upended by this research because it's made it very clear that we are beings who experience emotion first, and then we reflect on it. Really important. And this is why, if we get stuck in an emotion, if we don't make it all the way through the tunnel of that emotion, we feel it as exhaustion in our bodies because we're not going all the way through the tunnel to the light at the end. And we'll sort of unpack that more as we go. There are lots of reasons why we get stuck. It is not some kind of failure or character or personality. So let's just put paid to that right now. Some of us have been dismissed by other people because of emotional experiences that we might have been stuck in or that we might have been having that were very intense. I've had that experience. I've done that to people. So this is a pretty common thing, I think. But it's just important going right into this to kind of just set that aside. Getting stuck in this cycle, this beginning, middle, and end of an emotional experience in our bodies is not unusual. There's lots of reasons why it happens, and there's things we can do about it. So we're going to get into that. So here's a couple of reasons why we might get stuck in that cycle. We can get stuck in the embodied emotion of stress, for instance, which is sort of the emotion that we're focusing on to illustrate these things. We can get stuck in embodied stress because we have to return to the cause of the stress every day. Let's say a stressful job, right? So we're going back into, we're facing the same stressor over and over again, and that's one of the reasons why we can't move along with it. I heard an interview with someone this week who was talking about brand new survey results that have been gathered from public educators, from teachers under these present circumstances. And teachers are professional people. They are careful what they say for all sorts of legitimate reasons. But even so, the survey results showed a group of people that weren't sleeping well, that weren't eating well, that were struggling to complete routine tasks, and were struggling in their relationships. So just a hurting bunch of people. The short version is this was a category of people that were going into a stressful job every day, and the stressful circumstances, the uniquely stressful circumstances in that job were not relenting. And so they couldn't get through the stress tunnel, at least not very often. Or with any sort of ease. So that's really hard. I was intrigued by my own reactions to this story. I know lots of teachers. There are a whole bunch of teachers in our community. And I'm listening to this story while I was driving. And because I've been studying this stuff, maybe I was paying a little more attention to my body while I was listening to the story. And I could feel my chest tightening up. I could feel my stomach saying, "This is stressful. This is new stressful. This is different stressful." And my rational brain wanted to deflect the whole thing because the survey was taken primarily in Ontario and points east of there. And so my brain was like, "Yeah, that's really bad. And that's not my friends. Like, that's over there. That's in Ontario where things are really bad, right?" And my brain just wanted to squish that, which again, we'll talk about in a moment. But my body was not lying to me. This is now, and this is here. And when I can understand a bit more about how emotions work, I can maybe start to both understand the stress my friends that are teachers are under, and maybe empathize with that in a more whole person way. And of course, there are lots of other jobs that have this same dilemma and lots of other circumstances that can present that dilemma. That's an illustration that is not exhaustive. So that's one of the reasons we sometimes get stuck in the stress cycle. We get stuck because we're returning to the stressor or the stressful situation every day. It's recurring. Another reason we sometimes get stuck in the stress cycle is because we can't find our way through. We just can't do it. And this is especially true about maybe some of the really more difficult feelings, things like rage or grief, despair, helplessness, shame, that kind of bundle. It can be really hard to navigate the strength of some of those feelings and their complexity. And sometimes we just need help. We need a caring, loving, supportive person or community of persons to help us get through that. And sometimes we get stuck because it's not safe to go through. Lots of us have been taught that if we fix the situation or the problem that's causing the emotion, so if we deal with the stressor, then we will have dealt with the stress, we will have dealt with the emotion. But that's actually not the way emotions work. Most of us have been taught to believe what other people are saying about our bodies more than we believe what our bodies are trying to say to us directly. And when someone tells us about our stressful, or when we tell someone about our stressful situation, they might say something like, "Well, what have you done about the situation? Have you, Tim, you talked about this. I'm not saying Jane did this, but you were illustrating this kind of conversation this morning where someone is like, have you done what you can about this?" Very important. We need to do what we can. We need to be proactive. And so we're having a conversation about an emotion that we're stuck with. And we tell a person about the situation that's causing the emotion, and they're like, "Well, what have you done about the situation?" And I know that there's a stereotype here that comes from somewhere, which is the guys want to fix things. And, you know, so maybe this is, somebody in our community commented in one of our hangout chats the other day about in their own relationship with their spouse, where sometimes they've learned as the guy in this relationship to say, "Is this a conversation where you are telling me about it so because you want me to fix it? Or is this a conversation where you're telling me about it because you just want me to listen and need me to listen?" And then they kind of feel like they know better, you know, how to operate in there. But sometimes people will tell someone about something we're stuck with emotionally, where we just have these strong feelings and they're not going away and they're wearing us out. We're just bleh, because of them. And they say, "Well, what have you done about the situation? What was the situation?" And we tell them what we've done. It was this thing at work, and so we went through the chain of that HR lays out for these things, and we filed the complaint, and we did this, and we did that, and we were active, we were proactive, we addressed ourselves to the stressor. And they were like, "How'd that go?" And they're like, "Well, you know, the HR did this, and this person was, you know, disciplined, and that was great. It was a happy story, right? But I'm still, oh, that's why I'm talking to you." And we get something back like, "Well, you know, you've dealt with it, right? Like, so time to move on, right? Time to just put that aside, put it in a box, put it away, move on." That is not an uncaring response. It's also not correct. And so we're going to talk more about that. And I feel like so much resonance about this because I feel like I am so often that person on the other end of the conversation who's like, "What did you do? That's great. Way to go. Let's move on." And maybe especially as a parent, I can hear my parent voice doing this. I can hear it in my head saying to one of my kids, "You know what? Well, we've dealt with the stressor. And so now it's time to stop being wound up about it and just, you know, get on with it." You know, no, that is actually not the way this works. But this can be complicated because sometimes the safest thing that we can do is stuff down a feeling. And I know this sounds contrary to lots of self-help advice, but stay with me here. Sometimes it's not the right time to engage fully with an emotion. And it's not that hard to think of illustrations once you start thinking about it, right? Sometimes it's because the kids are standing right there. This is not the moment. Or because your boss is still leaning over your cubicle, right? Or because the guy on the other side of the street who just yelled something misogynistic and derogatory at you is still there on the other side of the street. And if you respond to this fully right then, all that's going to happen is it's going to escalate and it's going to get more dangerous. So sometimes it's not the right time. And sometimes we make a good choice, but we're still left stuck. So I won't tell you this whole story, but I remember an occasion in my life where I happened to cross paths with someone unexpectedly who had really hurt me deeply and hurt my family deeply, and which is a double whammy for me, right? And we met in a physical circumstance where it felt to me like it would be entirely plausible for me to actually push them over the railing of the bridge that we were on. I did not push them over the railing. I carried on. I left the situation there and moved on. And so part of me could kind of be going like, "Good job, Tim. Like, good choice." I would contend to this day that I made the better of the available choices in that instant. But here's the question. The rage that welled up inside of me when I saw that person in that moment and that was tempted to physically, you know, do them in. What happened to the rage? Did it stay there on the bridge when I walked away? No, it didn't. I removed the stressor, but I didn't deal with the stress. That's what we're talking about. And the research that these folks have done would say to me in that moment on the bridge, they would say, good choice, and you're not done with that emotion. You're still in the middle of it. Don't get stuck there. So, what happens in our bodies if we get stuck in the emotional tunnel? Why do we experience that as exhaustion? There's lots of factors. It depends on the emotion, it depends on the duration, it depends on the circumstances, and so on. But way of helping us get just at least a bit of an inkling about this, I want to sort of close what we're exploring today with some illustrations about this. And then we're going to sort of wrap it for today, just because of time. And we'll pick it up there again tomorrow. And I'll start with a bit of a summary. So if you're jumping in next week and weren't here this week, then there might be a chance to kind of catch up a little bit. But these are going to be pretty interlocking pieces. So by way of helping us kind of get a little feel for this, though, let's just talk a bit about the emotion of stress and what happens inside of our bodies if we get stuck in the emotion of stress, which we can for all those reasons. Some of us are in the middle of the stress tunnel because we're going into a stressful job every day. Hard to just sort of make the stressor go away, but what can we do about the stress, right? So what happens inside of us when we get stuck in an emotion, in any emotion? Let's say stress. So here, we're just going to kind of go system by system, and I won't be exhaustive. I'll just hit some of the high points. So let's take our cardiovascular system, for example. So we already know our neurological system is like, bzzz, right? It already sent all the messages. So what happens after we've experienced that stress to our cardiovascular system is that our blood vessels, which are designed to handle sort of a steady pulsing flow from the beat of our heart, this is one of the reasons why we regulate our hearts if they're in trouble, is because our whole cardiovascular system is built for this steady pulsing flow. But when we're under stress, our adrenal gland, which is part of our endocrine system, touch on that again in a moment, squirts this stuff directly into our bloodstream. It happens in less than a second. Everything gets elevated, including our heart rate. So now what's happening inside of our blood vessels is that instead of the steady pulsing flow, it's like somebody, instead of the garden hose, somebody took the fire hose and just opened the nozzle all the way up, and it's like whoosh, and there's all of this energized, oxygenated blood like pounding through our cardiovascular system. Now, our bodies can handle that quite well. They're actually designed for that. If it lasts as long as it's supposed to. And this is important. In the environments in which we evolved and in which our bodies evolved, we would need that supercharged state long enough to either run away or to fight something off or to get ourselves hid so we could freeze. And on average, our bodies seem to think our bodies seem to think that we should be able to accomplish that in about 10 minutes. That's about how long we're equipped to handle fire hose volume, cardiovascular activity, and that level of stress. 10 minutes. But if we stay in an elevated stress situation, if we stay there for hours, for days, for weeks, for months, for a year, it puts a kind of stress on our blood vessels that make weak places in them. Because they're just under too much duress for too long, they can't spring back. And those weak places are where plaques form, and that's what causes heart disease. So, pretty amazing, right? Pretty strong linkage in there. Endocrine system. Our endocrine system is it's the chemical message system that injects hormones directly into our bloodstream that regulate what other organs are doing. So, our adrenal gland, for instance, is a key gland in our endocrine system. Man, when we get under stress, those messages get messed up, right? Because again, here's a system that's designed to give us this squirt of hormonal information that elevates all these other systems so we can deal with the situation and then to put the brakes on and dial them down. It's interesting, right? And so when we're in a situation where we need to stop something, where we need to stuff an emotion down, we're choosing to put the brakes on that system for a time. But then how do we let the brakes off later? So we can actually move the rest of the way through the emotion in our bodies and we can carry on. We can make room for other emotions. So that's kind of how that endocrine system works. Very short version. How about this one? Our digestive systems. We know that emotion gets us in the gut, right? Somebody posted something the other day about a stressful situation at work, and they talked about stress farts. This is our gut kind of going, this is stressful. What actually happens when we get stuck in an emotion is that our upper digestive system slows down and our lower digestive system speeds up. And if we keep ourselves under those circumstances, we're just on the train that's headed for irritable bowel syndrome. That's kind of how that works. So those are all sort of just, as I said, high points. And that is a most unpleasant list. That is, those are not things that any of us would want to be going through or have going on in our bodies. We don't want to get stuck in the stress tunnel. We don't want to get hung up in there. We want to move through it and we want to move on. So, how do we get out of the tunnel if we're stuck in there? Well, that would be where we're going to pick things up next week. So, at the risk of making, bad television, join us next week on this channel when we ask Tim and the authors of this book, anyway, not Tim, just the smart people, but I'm happy to relay the information. So that's where we're going to pick it up when we get together next week. That's all I'm going to say about that for now. I'm going to go. We'll chat again soon. Take good care. Peace.